Pull up a chair. Get that coffee close, because this one's got a chill in it, and I don't just mean the story. It's the first day of January 1929, Northern Alberta. And I want you to understand what cold actually means up there, because most of us throw the word around like it's nothing. This is the kind of cold where the air itself feels solid, where your breath freezes on your collar and stays there, where an open cockpit airplane is not a romantic notion. It's a slow way to lose your fingers. I'm Taildragger, and this is The Hangar, here on Radio Hangar, where we keep the old stories flying. Today we're going to talk about two men, one little biplane with no roof on it, and roughly 600 miles of nothing but forest and river and frozen muskeg between a city and a town that was about to die. Now here's where it gets interesting, because this isn't a story about a warbird or a speed record. This is a story about what an airplane is for, what it's really for, when everything else has failed. Before we get into it, let me tell you today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up the ladder. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And after you hear this one, you might understand why some of us like to carry a little piece of the history in our pocket. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let me set the scene properly. Up in a little settlement called Little Red River, way up in the north country of Alberta, there was a Hudson's Bay Company post and a mission, and in the last days of December 1928, a man came down sick, throat closing up, fever. The doctor in the region, a fellow by the name of Harold Hammond, took one look and knew exactly what he was dealing with, diphtheria. Now you younger pilots may have never even heard that word said out loud with fear in it. We've got a vaccine now, we've had one for a long time, but in 1929, diphtheria was a killer, and it was a killer that liked children best. It grows a thick gray membrane across the back of the throat until the airway closes and the patient simply cannot breathe. It's called the strangling angel. That's what they called it, the strangling angel of children. And here's the terrible part. There was a whole community up there. Native families, trappers, the mission, the trading post, and diphtheria doesn't stay in one throat. It spreads, one case up in that cold, isolated country, and the doctor knew he was looking at an epidemic that could wipe out the entire settlement before spring. He had a little bit of antitoxin on hand. A little, he used it. But he needed more, and he needed it fast. And the nearest real supply of diphtheria antitoxin was down in Edmonton. Now Edmonton is about 600 miles south, and this is the dead of winter. There's no road that means anything. The way people moved freight up to that country in January was by dog team and by horse-drawn sleigh over the frozen rivers and the bush trails. That doctor did the math. By dog sled, the serum would take 2 weeks to get up there. Maybe more, 2 weeks. The whole settlement would be gone in 2 weeks, so the doctor did the only thing left to do. He got word out. A relay of dog sled and telegraph carried the message south, and it landed on the desk of the Deputy Minister of Health for the province of Alberta, and that man had a decision to make that nobody had ever really made before, not like this. He could send the serum the slow, safe way and pray, or he could put it in an airplane. Now understand something. In 1929, nobody flew that country in the winter. Nobody. Bush flying in Canada was still being invented month by month by a handful of men who mostly flew in the summer when you could put floats on and land on a lake. Come winter, the airplanes got put away. The engines wouldn't start in the cold. The oil turned to tar. There were no heated hangars up there, no weather reports worth the name, no navigation aids, nothing. You flew by looking out the side of the airplane at the rivers below and hoping you recognized the bends. And the only airplane available in Edmonton that could even make the attempt was a little Avro Avian. Let me tell you about her. The Avro Avian was a British-built light biplane, a trainer, really, a sport plane, fabric over a wood and metal frame, a wingspan you could just about touch both tips of if you stood in the middle and stretched. She had a little Cirrus engine up front, right around 80-90 horsepower on a good day, and she had two open cockpits. Open, no canopy, no cabin heat, no heat of any kind. You sat out in the wind with your face in the slipstream. This was not a bush plane. This was not built for the Arctic. This was a fair-weather airplane. The kind of thing a gentleman flew around an English aerodrome on a Sunday afternoon. And somebody was proposing to fly at 600 miles into the coldest part of the Canadian winter. Now here's where our two men come in. The pilot was a fellow named Wilfred May, but nobody on this earth ever called him Wilfred. They called him WOP, W-O-P. He'd gotten the nickname as a baby from a little cousin who couldn't say his name right, and it stuck to him his whole life. WOP May. And WOP May was not just any pilot. This was a man with history in him. Back in the Great War on the Western Front, Wap Mae was a brand new fighter pilot, green as grass on one of his first combat flights, and a red triplane came down on his tail and chased him low across the ground, guns hammering, and Wap Mae could not shake him no matter what he did. That red triplane belonged to Manfred von Richthofen, the Red Baron himself. 80 victories, the deadliest pilot of the war. And Wap Mae, a rookie, was about to be number 81. A friend of May's dove in to save him, a Canadian named Roy Brown, and in the chase that followed, the Red Baron was hit and went down and was killed. To this day, people argue about whether it was Roy Brown's guns or a rifleman on the ground that got him. But here's the fact that matters. On the day the Red Baron died, the man he was chasing, the man in his gun sight in the last minute of his life, was Wap Mae. So this was the pilot. A man who had already looked death in the face at close range and walked away. 10 years later, he was flying commercial in Edmonton, running a little aviation company, and when the call came, he did not hesitate. His companion was a young mechanic and pilot named Vic Horner, and they'd need him, because you did not fly that country alone in winter. You needed a second set of hands and a second set of eyes, and somebody to help you nurse the engine and, God forbid, help you survive if you went down in the bush. Now, the serum itself was a problem all its own. Here's a thing people don't think about. Diphtheria antitoxin freezes, and if it freezes, it's ruined, useless. So they had a bundle of glass bottles of the most precious cargo in the province, and they were about to carry it in an open cockpit in temperatures that could hit 30, 40 below zero. The solution was almost comically simple, and it nearly killed them. They wrapped the serum bottles in blankets, and they packed a charcoal heater in with them, a little burning bundle of charcoal to keep the whole package above freezing. So now Wap Mae is sitting in an open cockpit airplane in the dead of winter with a small fire smoldering in his lap. A fire in a fabric airplane full of gasoline, that was the plan, that was the best they had. They took off from Edmonton on January 2, 1929, and the cold came for them immediately.
Picture it, there is no windshield worth the name. The wind is coming over the cowling at maybe 80, 90 miles an hour, and it is somewhere below zero, and it is hitting you full in the face for hours. Your goggles ice over from the inside, your breath freezes into ice on the fur around your mouth. Wap Mae said later that the cold got so deep into him, he could not feel his hands or his feet, and he had to work the controls almost by memory, by the shape of the stick in a hand he could no longer feel. And that charcoal heater, that little life-saving fire keeping the serum from freezing, it was giving off fumes, carbon monoxide most likely, and smoke, right up into the cockpit, into two men who could not exactly open a window, because the whole airplane was window. They were being slowly poisoned by the very thing keeping their cargo alive. They flew north following the rivers, the Athabasca, the Lesser Slave. They landed at a little settlement called McLennan to warm up and refuel, and they could barely climb out of the airplane, frozen half to death, half sick from the fumes, and only partway there. Now here's where it gets interesting, because the weather turned on them. The temperature dropped further, a cold snap came down out of the north, the kind of deep Arctic cold that makes machinery simply quit, and they still had the worst of it ahead from McLennan up to Fort Vermilion and the Little Red River country. There was nothing, no settlements, no place to land and get warm. If the engine quit out there over the frozen bush, nobody was coming to find them until spring, if ever. They made a decision that any old bush pilot will tell you is the whole game up north. They decided to keep going. Because behind them, in that little settlement, children were choking to death, and every hour mattered. They pressed on into the cold. The little Cirrus engine, that 80-some horsepower motor that was never designed for any of this, just kept turning. And I want you to sit with that for a second, because that's the unsung hero of this whole story. A little British sport plane engine, out in temperatures that should have frozen it solid, out over hundreds of miles of wilderness. And it never missed a beat. They kept it running partly by never letting it get truly cold. When you shut down up there, you drained the oil and you kept it warm by a fire, and you poured it back in hot before you started. That's how they did it. That's bush flying in 1929. Half aviator, half blacksmith. They reached Fort Vermilion. They got the first batch of serum into the doctor's hands. And then they pushed on, because the outbreak had spread, and there was more country to cover, and more people who needed it. Two men in a Sunday sport plane doing the work of a whole medical corps, in cold that would kill an unprotected man in an hour. And then they turned around and flew all the way back to Edmonton. Now think about the return trip. The serum is delivered, the mission is done, but they are still 600 miles out in an open cockpit, still half frozen, still breathing fumes, still flying an airplane that has every reason to quit. There's no glory in the trip home. There's just the cold, and the rivers below, and the hope that the engine holds one more day. They came into Edmonton on the January 6th, and here's the part that always gets me. Word had spread across the whole country by telegraph and by radio and by newspaper, the Mercy flight. Everybody in Canada knew, and when Wap May and Vic Horner brought that little Avro Avian back over the city, there were thousands of people waiting on the field. Some accounts say 5,000, 10,000, standing out in the January cold on a frozen airfield to see two half-dead men climb out of an open cockpit airplane.
They had to lift Wap May out of the cockpit. He was so frozen and so sick from the fumes he could barely stand. They carried both men off, but they'd done it. They had flown roughly 600 miles each way, through Arctic winter, in an airplane that had absolutely no business being up there, and they had beaten the strangling angel. The outbreak was stopped. The settlement lived. And now let me tell you why this one matters, beyond just being a good yarn to tell on a cold morning. Before this flight, the airplane in Canada, and honestly in a lot of the world, was still seen as a toy, a daredevil's plaything, something for barnstormers and record chasers and rich men on Sunday afternoons. The average person did not think an airplane was a serious thing that mattered to ordinary life. And then two men flew a little biplane 600 miles into the deep freeze and saved a town full of children, and the whole country read about it over their breakfast. And people began to understand, all at once, what this machine could actually do. That an airplane could reach the places nothing else could reach, that it could beat the distance and beat the season and beat the odds when a human life was on the line. That flight, more than any race, more than any stunt, is a big part of why Canada went on to build one of the great bush flying traditions in the world. The idea of the Mercy flight, the flying doctor, the airplane as a lifeline to the far country. A lot of that traces right back to Wap May and Vic Horner and that charcoal heater smoking away in an open cockpit in January of 1929. Wap May kept flying, by the way. He went on to become one of the great pioneers of aviation in the Canadian North. He helped run a manhunt from the air a few years later, chasing a fugitive across the Arctic, another famous chapter. He trained pilots in the Second World War, a whole life in aviation, and it very nearly ended before it started, in the gunsight of the Red Baron. But I think this flight was his finest hour. Not the dogfight, not the records. A cold, miserable, dangerous slog through the winter sky to carry a few bottles of medicine to people he had never met and would never meet. No guns, no enemy, just the cold and the distance and the will to keep the engine turning one more mile. That's what an airplane is for. That's what it's really for. Now the details of this one I owe to the historical record kept up in Alberta and by the folks who preserve Canadian aviation history and to the accounts handed down about Wap May's remarkable life. If you want to read more, and you should, it's worth your time. You can always find your way over to radiohanger.com if you want to see what else we've been digging into around here. So the next time you're grumbling about a cold morning pre-flight, and your fingers are stiff on the tie-downs, and you're wishing you'd sprung for a heated hangar, think about two men in an open cockpit with a fire in their lap and no feeling left in their hands, flying north because somebody up there needed them to. Keep those old stories flying. This is Tail Dragger, and I'll see you next time.